So what I'm going to talk about, this is the 40th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War, and the title of our presentation is The Continuing Challenge of Protecting Civilians During Armed Conflict. I have no conflicts of interest, however, I, along with Dr. Seidel, receive a very small amount of royalties from books that we've co-edited on war, terrorism, and social injustice and the relationship with public health. I got interested in issues of war and public health in two sets of things that happened. One is that in 1980, I went to work in a Cambodian refugee camp along the Thai border, which is about 3 miles away from the border. And what I saw there really moved me in such a way that I committed at that point to devote more of my career related to issues of war and genocide. I came back from that experience and shared it with over 100 people, 100 different groups of people in various settings, from professional conferences to even daycare centers where my children were at that time. Some of the images that I took back from that experience working in the refugee camp, where there were about 125,000 Cambodians who were allowed into Thailand at the end of the Khmer Rouge period, where probably 1.5 to 2 million Cambodians out of the population of 7 million died, so-called killing fields during that period of time, when the Khmer Rouge moved everybody out of the cities and tortured a lot of people, starved many. There were no medical services, no public health services, and those people, many of the survivors, came into these camps seeking refuge, and we offered medical care and public health services. A boy who had injured, he was carrying his younger brother across the Thai-Cambodian border, and he was shot. He was lucky to survive. His 4-year-old brother, whom he was carrying, was not so fortunate. A man who suffered serious injuries and was in the rehabilitation center in the camp. A child who could no longer see after witnessing the killing of both of his parents by the Khmer Rouge. A young child who was severely malnourished, a 7-year-old girl who weighs 27 pounds. And we also saw a lot in terms of the aid that came in terms of nutrition, direct medical care for children. Many of the malnourished children had infectious diseases, like this young boy with measles, and measles became a very serious disease among malnourished children, and this child who had apparent polio, which led to an immunization campaign run by Cambodian public health workers in the camp under the guidance of many of us from the United States and other countries. There was even a clinic for people to get eyeglasses, because anyone who wore eyeglasses during the Khmer Rouge period of genocide was almost immediately killed, because glasses were a sign of education. And yet we saw the amazing resilience of the people there and the dignity that they shared. So this was one experience that led me to get more interested in war and related issues, including the impact of war on non-combatant civilians. The other had to do with joining up with Vic Seidel in 1991. That was at the time of the Persian Gulf War, which ended up being a very popular war in this country, although the approval of the U.S. Congress to go forward with that war was a razor-thin margin. I think it was 53 to 47, but it became a very popular war, and there was very little focus on the impact of the war, particularly on non-combatant civilians and civilians who are forced into the Iraq military by Saddam Hussein. They were technically military, but they were serving. They were mandated to serve. They were drafted into serving, often against their own wishes. And so the impact on that war was significant. And Vic and I, in 1991, chaired a session at this APHA annual meeting on war and public health, which ultimately led to two editions of a textbook on war and public health, and a almost 25-year collaboration among the two of us, writing books, giving talks, hopefully inspiring a younger generation of people to follow in our footsteps in one way or another. So today I'm going to talk about Vic's and my collective work looking at the impact of war on non-combatant civilians. This happens to be the year, not only a lot of positive anniversaries in terms of public health at the present time, but also some grim anniversaries as shown here. It's the 40th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War. It's also the 70th anniversary of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the 100th anniversary of the first use of aerial bombing of civilian populations, the bombing of people in London at the start of World War I and throughout World War I. We could spend the entire afternoon, and I know there are other presenters, I know Dr. Lukian will be presenting later more about the Vietnam War, but just as a brief overview of some of the horrors of that war and the impact on people's health and indeed mortality. Four million deaths estimated in that war, 1 million widows in South Vietnam alone, almost 1 million orphans in South Vietnam alone. But of course, since the Vietnam War, there have been many other wars. These are just a few of them where the impact has been huge among non-combatant civilians. In the Civil War in the Democratic Republic of Congo, almost 5 million people have died. In the wars of the Balkans, 140,000. Iraq, more than 400,000 civilians. Some studies suggest even 650,000 civilians were killed in that war. The current civil war in Syria, at least 200,000 civilians. And as my colleague Vic Seidel has pointed out many times, statistics are people with the tears washed away. So we need to be thinking as public health professionals not only about the data and statistics and the evidence that supports our concern about the horrors of war on non-combatant civilians, we also need to be thinking about the stories like the ones I just illustrated of the children and adults in the refugee camp in Thailand and their individual stories, because it's ultimately stories that move people. So we need a balance as we talk about these horrors. We need to communicate both the statistics and the data, but we also need to tell the stories, the human component of it. One way of looking at the adverse health consequences of war is shown on this slide, and I'll go through these with examples in a moment. Direct impacts on health. Turns out that much morbidity, maybe most morbidity and mortality in war is not due to bullets and bombs and missiles, but rather the impact on the health supporting infrastructure of society. When that gets damaged in terms of a safe water supply, when the food supply gets damaged, when basic sectors of society are damaged, transportation, communication, electrical power, and very importantly, of course, public health services and medical care, that has a huge impact on morbidity and mortality. Indeed, there are also mental health problems that are important part of that in terms of and the focus has often been on the military impact, although the impact of mental health problems on civilian populations is huge in comparison to military. But the data in terms of studies are often focused on the military in terms of PTSD, depression, and other disorders. 75% of veterans returning from Vietnam War reported psychiatric disorders. A third of veterans returning from the Iraq War used mental health services just in the first year that they had returned. Many non-combatant civilians suffer mental health problems, many more than military personnel, although this has not been as adequately studied. I did it just recently, a very quick PubMed search, putting in the terms mental health, war, and military, and found almost 900 publications. But when I changed the military term to civilians, the number of publications was about 50. So there's like a 17-fold and almost 20-fold increase in studying the impact of mental health problems from war on military rather than on civilian populations. Social and cultural factors also inhibit the identification of mental health disorders in many cultures, including cultures where many wars are fought in low-income countries. And so the numbers may actually be even higher than the few studies suggest. The kinds of, I've already covered this in a sense, but the kinds of morbidity and mortality related to the damage to the health supporting infrastructure are often not well quantified. In fact, they're rarely quantified, and I already covered some of these areas already. In terms of the effects on medical care and public health services, some of those are shown on the slide. Physicians, nurses, and other healthcare workers are injured or killed, or they flee. Damage to clinics and hospitals, reduction of public health services, damage to the food, the cold chain of getting vaccines to people who are being vaccinated, and indeed reduced medications and vaccines getting through. Chemical contamination of the environment is often widespread, another area that's not very well studied. Agent Orange, a defoliant and herbicide, was used extensively in the Vietnam War. And these are just a few of the many malignancies and other health problems that are associated, that have been associated and formally determined to be associated by our own government with Agent Orange exposure. In the Persian Gulf War, many people were exposed to air contaminants from over 600 oil fires that were set by retreating Iraqi troops. And many other people were exposed, many non-combatant civilians, to depleted uranium. This picture shows some of the damage that Agent Orange did in Vietnam, the destruction of mangrove swamps, and many U.S. service people were exposed to Agent Orange, but many, many more Vietnamese non-combatant civilians were exposed. This slide, by the way, is another mangrove swamp where there are bomb craters. You can see those circles there, which filled up with water over time. They become breeding grounds for mosquitoes that carry malaria and other malaria-borne, vector-borne diseases in this tropical climate. Forced migration is another issue. There are combined 50 million refugees and internally displaced persons in the world, about a third of whom are refugees, two-thirds internally displaced persons. During the first almost 5 years of the Iraq War, almost 5 million refugees and internally displaced persons were created by that war. More than 4 million refugees from the civil war in Syria, and indeed that number may be larger with each passing day. The world is focused on the refugees themselves, but like so many other problems having to do with human rights and public health, there hasn't been as much attention on the not only the war in Syria, but the situations that led to that war and what we can do to help prevent those kinds of situations in the future. Of course, refugees and internally displaced persons are at increased vulnerability for all the reasons listed here, and they're often preyed upon, including by people who promise to transport them to so-called host countries in Europe and leave them in dangerous boats or locked up in trucks, where the recent episode, I believe, in Austria, where 71 refugees were found dead. Diversion of resources is an important issue that indirectly impacts on non-combatant civilians. A Republican president, former five-star general, said every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket signifies in the final sense a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and not clothed. The cost of two recent wars, the Vietnam War, and these are estimated costs, not often taking into account all the indirect costs on families and on communities. Vietnam War, I purposely didn't use the word billion spelled out, but put the zeros here to give us some sense of the magnitude, $738 billion. The Iraq War, when all is said and done, $3 trillion, the cost of the war. That money needs to be coming from somewhere else. And although there isn't always a one-to-one relationship, it certainly is impacting on resources available for public health and social services and education and a number of other positive things. These figures are 3 years old, so they're no doubt higher now. These are military expenditures by country. United States, $685 billion. Europe, about $500 billion, and so forth. The numbers are staggering compared to the budgets and the cost of public health services that would prevent many more illnesses than military expenditures would. Now, if you look at rankings of, and this is from the CIA World Factbook estimates for 2015, at least with regard to life expectancy and infant mortality, and if anyone doubts this, I have the list with me here. But according to the CIA, we rank 43rd in the world in life expectancy, a little bit better since a year ago when I gave a similar talk, and 58th in the world in infant mortality, a little bit worse than we did about a year ago. But we're first in arms in exports, military expenditures, military technology, and so forth. And another indirect effect of war is that it promotes more war and other violence. Not only other wars, but as veterans come home, they are at higher risk of perpetrating domestic violence and getting involved in community violence. War causes more war, violence causes more violence. Fueling those conflicts are the international arms trade, which has grown about 56% over the last, well, at least between the year 2000 and the year 2012. And not to anyone's surprise, the United States accounts for about 30% share of global arms exports, U.S. and Russia together well over half. There's a lot that needs to be done, and I don't mean to be glib about this or say that any of this is simple, but in terms of protecting non-combatant civilians, transforming the protection of civilians during war, prosecuting civilian targeting, that is when civilians are targeted, which is happening unfortunately increasingly frequently, to prosecute that as a war crime, protecting the health supporting infrastructure that's so vital to our daily lives and preventing illness and death, evacuating non-combatant civilians, and maintaining medical neutrality. I just learned in the last day or so that, and it was Susanna Serkin who presented at the Health Activist Dinner last night who pointed out that almost 750 Syrian health professionals, doctors, nurses, EMTs, and other health professionals have been killed in the 4 or 5 years since the Syrian civil war began, and often they have been targeted specifically because they're healthcare providers. We also need to transform the public mindset to enable people to recognize that non-combatant civilians are not part of the enemy's military. They're not necessarily enemy supporters. We need to address social and psychological forces that permit and encourage military forces to injure and kill civilians. And we need to consider all wars, not only as potential, but actually as arenas for war crimes. All wars are war crimes. There's a lot of what we can do as health professionals to document and raise awareness about the plight of non-combatant civilians, not only, as I said, by reporting data, but by telling the stories of those affected people, like the children I mentioned earlier. Roles of health professionals also, of course, involve providing direct assistance, not only in war zones, but back here in this country, to veterans, to refugees, to others who have been in war zones and need assistance in one way or another. And of course, we're advocating for policies and practices to protect non-combatant civilians, not only during war itself, but in the aftermath of war. In the 7 years after the Persian Gulf War in 1991, the United States continued with sanctions, economic sanctions that kept food and medicines and other essential items from the Iraqi population, and UNICEF determined that, or they estimated that 400,000 children died as a result of those sanctions during that 7 or 8 year period. Now, another way we as public health professionals look at problems, how many of you are familiar with this triangle? Okay, so we learn in terms of infectious disease, you know, if it's malaria, well, you can focus on the host or the environment where mosquitoes breed, as I mentioned before, and the actual agents themselves, but you can change the points on the triangle to something like this. So you can think in terms of, in the prevention of war, you can think about people, the conditions in which people live, weapons and military, host, agents, and environment. So that may help us, and again, I don't mean to be glib, I don't mean that any of this is easy, but at least providing a framework to think about how to prevent war, how to minimize the consequences of war, strategies aimed at people, one point of the triangle, would include promoting an understanding among people, promoting economic and social interdependency among nations, promoting nonviolent resolutions of disputes and conflicts, and developing the popular and political will to prevent war and promote peace. Strategies aimed at weapons in the military. And by the way, strategies can not only focus on the points of this, as we learned in school of public health, but the interaction between the points, the lines between the various points of the triangle. So how the host interacts with the environment or with agents, or how agents interact with the environment. So similarly here, how people interact with weapons in the military, how you can build opposition to the militarism that is so rampant in this country and part of our national policy. So strategies aimed at weapons in the military to control the arms trade, to eliminate weapons of mass destruction, to reduce military expenditures, and to intervene in disputes to prevent war, even to conduct surveillance to identify risk factors for war before a war actually breaks out and hopefully resolve conflicts by nonviolent means. And finally, strategies to improve the conditions in which people live, which are often the underlying reasons for war, protect human rights and civil liberties, reduce poverty and economic disparities, improve education and employment opportunities, and ensure personal security and legal protections. Even if some of us focused on any one of the things I've talked about this morning, we would be making progress. It's very easy, of course, to get overwhelmed with issues like this and say, it's hopeless, there's nothing can be done. But in fact, there are some statistics, as bad as the situation is in the civil war in Syria and what has been happening in Afghanistan and a number of other places around the world, global statistics suggest that perhaps there may indeed be fewer conflicts at the present time than there were 20 years ago. And that's not in any way to condone what's happening or to minimize the huge impact, but progress is being made, although it's often hard to see when we're focusing on the things that are happening right at the moment. And to end, the only way really to prevent the impact of war on non-combatant civilians is to end war itself. Thank you. I'd be happy to take any questions or hear any comments. Am I just preaching to the converted here? Or is anything that you want to share? Please, yes.
I just have a general comment. First of all, your speech was very interesting.
Thank you.
But carbon civilians by military has been a strategy of war since the end of civilization. Every military has done something, whether it's burning the crop fields just deliberately injuring civilizations with psychological damage.
Yes.
How, I mean, this is a very broad question that seems very helpful at times, but how can we introduce rules into warfare, or at least mitigate the effects of these kinds of strategies of warfare to make war more civilized or humane in the process?
Let me repeat the question. So the question really has to do with how can we make war humane, create wars, rules of combat that would spare non-combatant civilians. And again, there's no easy answer. Let me relate something that Susanna Serkin said in the same presentation last night when she received an International Health Award. She talked about the fact that Physicians for Human Rights has been instrumental in addressing systematic rape of women in places like Bosnia and civil wars in Africa and so forth, and ultimately trying to hold accountable the perpetrators of rape and other human rights abuses. One way of doing that, and there's, you know, there's policy and there's advocacy and there's all, but there's also some technical solutions that are part of this. And if I have this correct, part of what Physicians for Human Rights and perhaps other organizations have done have trained and empowered physicians to get evidence of rape, perhaps semen or other ways of getting DNA sampling and using that to help the potential prosecutors of these war, the perpetrators of war crimes be prosecuted. In other words, enabling physicians or others to gather evidence of what has been done. So again, I'm not trying to be glib. I don't pretend to say that's an easy answer, but and you're absolutely right. There have been crimes against non-combatant civilians since wars began, since the history of wars. They may be becoming more frequent. They're certainly becoming increasingly reported for a variety of reasons that we could go into. So I think there are some policy ways. I think there are some practical things that could be done to hold the perpetrators of war crimes responsible, and that would be one way of trying to inhibit or prevent that. Further comments or questions? Yes, please.
Yeah, I had
Charlie.
A question along the civil line.
Mm-hmm.
I think what you're advocating is noble, and I think it should be a story that's taken to the United Nations and our policy holders to see what can be done. But certainly, when we've seen recent wars where the enemy basically uses civilians as shields or the enemy armaments they have are in people's homes, It's very difficult to fix a market.
Right. That's true. Particularly if you're, like our country is, and allegedly Russia is trying to do, by dropping bombs on ISIS targets where we know for sure that there are non-combatant civilians being held against their will, you know, those non-combatant civilians, if that strategy of trying to find ISIS by dropping bombs continues, no doubt non-combatant civilians will suffer and die. So, which, raises questions about the validity of that strategy. I mean, the questions can be raised about the validity of that strategy, I think even from a military point of view, but you're absolutely right. It's a difficult issue when military uses or non-state actors use civilians as shields. I don't know if you want to make any further comment on that or any thoughts about how that might be addressed. I appreciate your identifying that though as a major issue. Yeah. Yes. Any other questions or comments?
Thank you very much.
Sure.